Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for tuning in to Fire Engineering Talk Radio. Each week, our host will introduce you to a various cast of characters you'll only find here. Each host will share experience, knowledge, and expertise regarding their years in the fire service, allowing you to call in and speak with them live, an experience you can only find on Fire Engineering Talk Radio. So thanks for joining us. Enjoy and stay safe.
Welcome, everybody, to the 1st Stu Battalion Chief. I'm Danny Sheridan, New York City Fire Department Battalion Chief, and I thought tonight we'd give you a little culture. I wanted to have my own intro, because everyone else at Teams now, there's a whole ton of these intros, and I didn't have one. So quite honestly, though, it was the only one that I could get off my computer that was the right format. So I think that was my daughter's symphony playing. So a little culture. But anyway, I'm honored tonight again to have Gary Nelson with us. Gary is a retired Los Angeles County District Chief. He's also an instructor with Mission Centered Solutions out of Colorado. And Gary is actually right now, again, in New York City doing another class, the Leadership Series 381 for the FDNY management team and for the officers and chiefs of the fire department. So, Gary, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hey, Gary.
Hi, Danny.
So, Gary, it's really, I'm sorry about last night. I was hoping that we were going to meet up, but we'll have to do this by phone, and I'm sure there'll be nothing lost because I could hear you pretty good. So, yeah, tonight I wanted to continue on that same vein. Last time, I believe we left off, we were talking about making memory slides and how that was influential, instrumental in us making decisions. And I think tonight I want to take that to the next step where we're actually making the decision.
Yeah, when, we were making memory slides all the time, sometimes we don't know that until we've been exposed to that theory we talked about last time. And I'm assuming that your listeners can take a listen to that, and that will tie into the decision-making we're going to talk about tonight.
Right, exactly. And I've been reading the book because I'm actually taking the class again next week, and I'm really looking forward to it. But I picked up something today in my readings where it says where an experienced officer or chief is actually an advantage because you have a bigger tray of slides. And I found myself actually in a position about, I would say now, a few weeks ago where we had a nice second alarm vacant building fire. And, you know, you make these naturalistic decisions, you know, and I found myself doing that night. And I immediately was able to draw, like, even though I haven't been to a vacant building fire, probably, I'm going to say at least 10 years maybe. I can't even remember the last vacant building fire I've been to. But it was like it happened yesterday, you know.
Yeah, that's the advantage of those slides. Once you develop a slide the way they happen in an experienced situation, it's in your subconscious memory forever, and you don't have to try to recall it. It pops up when you look at the same situation.
Yeah, I like the way you said that, how it's in there forever, and it was almost no time had passed. You know, back in the day, I guess in the mid-80s and up into the early 90s, in that same area, you know, it was not uncommon for us to go to a vacant building fire once a tour. And being in a towel ladder, an aerial device with the large caliber streams, I mean, we were called on quite often for these types of buildings. And, you know, it just got to be, you know, second nature for us. You know, these vacant buildings, the units, we saw a vacant building. The guys, the engines knew exactly how to position the apparatus to keep the engines out of the front of the building. And we cleared the building for the tower ladders. And basically, you know, it was just understood that we were going to be operating that way. And the other night, we got a call. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, I would say. And, you know, you get these gut feelings, you know. And I had this, you know, the way the alarm came in and the wording, it said, you know, vacant building on fire. And we're getting numerous calls. So I knew something was up. And I think my driver actually pointed it out that they had been there a few times in the last, like, 6 months for a few fires. So right away, my first thought was, okay, numerous fires in a frame building. You know, and Vinnie Dunn, he talks about a lifespan of a building like a human being about 75 years, you know. And So I coupled that, you know, just the immediate situational awareness was that, okay, vacant building, probably not a high life hazard, and the only life hazard is going to be us. And so pretty sure, like, as we were rolling out the door, that I was already starting that decision process, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure that when you rolled out the door, you had some basic situation awareness information about the building, and that triggers that process that, like you mentioned, you felt that intuitive gut feeling, and all experienced officers have that gut feeling, and the technique is to learn to trust that. And it sounds like you did on that incident.
Yeah. You know, I have to be honest, quite honest. I've been a chief for 5 years now, and that was actually the first time where I had to make the call like that to go to an exterior attack without even being at the building. I was probably out of quarters only 30 seconds when I heard the first two engine get on scene, and the size up was, you know, we had a fire in a three-story vacant building, top floor, heavy fire condition. And I just, right there, I got on the radio, I told dispatcher, I said, tell all the incoming units, you know, no one's going to make any entry until I get on the scene. But I was pretty much already, I kind of knew in my mind that we were going to go to an exterior attack on this. There's no sense anymore for me to, why play games? You know, like, why give it that 30 seconds or a minute to see, you know, go through these motions like we're going to stretch a line and attempt to put it out? Because, you know, there's no life. You know, the life hazard is very, very low. And the only thing that's going to happen is they're going to tear the building down anyway. So why risk getting guys hurt? You know, that's my thinking.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, we've lost way too many officers and firefighters and building collapses and vacant buildings. And so when you have that slide of that situation, you have to think about what is the probability of occupants in that building. And it's always possible, but it was a very low probability, and I think you made a good risk decision.
Right. And I think what reinforced that decision for me is, as we got closer, I was on scene, and I actually had some great pictures. My aide, when we rolled up, took some really great photos. And the building was all boarded up. I mean, the windows on the first floor and the front door were all plywooded up, and there was really no signs of anyone entering the building. So, I mean, that just kind of reinforced what I already felt was going to happen. And I just pulled the plug, and I said, listen, set up the tower ladder. You know, I was going to make this an outside operation. And it was a big relief for me, you know, because, you know, it's funny. When you're a fireman, you know, you think differently. You know, like you're new and you want to charge in and tear it up and all this bravado. And it's kind of funny now wearing the other hat, you know, what the thinking is. You know, I'm thinking more of outside looking in than being too immersed in it, you know. And the crux of it is really safety, really, when it boils down to it, right?
Yeah, you know, I remember that too, both as a firefighter and an engine captain, of wanting to be aggressive and fight fire because it's fun to fight fire. But when I became a chief officer and I thought, you know, I'm responsible for 50 people's lives, I really took a little different approach on risk management.
That's exactly it. I'm responsible for those guys' lives. And, you know, it's just, I wouldn't be able to get my head around it if, God forbid, I mean, how could I even rationalize that? Because, you know, what we do in the FDNY, which I like, is we've been doing it forever, is with vacant buildings, we'll mark them. And what we do now is we put a box, it's about 18 inches high, in lime green paint around, like, by the front entrance, and we put a big X on it. And that's supposed to signify to the units that, you know, that this building's vacant and that an outside operation is warranted, you know? And but I didn't,
you know,
I didn't.
I was here for another MCS class last year, and somebody told me about that, and I wanted to see it. So they took me down to look at one. I think that's a great marking system.
Exactly. At one time, we actually had a different system. It would be, we had just the box, and then there was a box with one line through it, and then a box with an X in it. And we've done away with now the whole two other options. It's just if it's a vacant building and there's no life and the hazard's going to be us, then it's an X, and it's going to be an exterior operation. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And I feel good because, like, I got the first one out of the way. I had a situation, it was last year, I believe, and I wasn't the first two chief. I wasn't the ICO with the operations chief. And it's a little different when you're coming in, and you have the luxury of getting a more of a situational awareness when you're coming from a longer distance because you're listening to everything that's going on.
And I agree.
What had happened this far, it was in the same area. It was a warehouse, and my gut, I just had a bad feeling in my gut that it had a gypsum roof, it had steel bar gypsum roof, and there was all kinds of water problems and heavy, heavy fire on arrival. And I think what happened was, you know, the first two chief was kind of focused on, like, getting that first line operation to give it a shot, as we say, that we're going to give it a shot. And I had the luxury, like, I came in from the B side, and I looked in this door, and I saw nothing but orange, and I saw heavy fire up in the rafters, you know. And, you know, I think sometimes, you know, what we need is sometimes a different set of eyes. We need good intel, like, hey, what's going on here, you know. And
yeah, I agree that we can do more of that, and the challenge is having the officers in command looking for all the information that paints a better picture and then being able to talk about that so the incident commander gets that information to have to make that decision if he has to.
Right. And I think that's a great point. I think it really comes down to communication where, you know, maybe I should have spoke up a little more at that fire, and I kind of held my tongue, and I felt afterwards like I should have said something, you know, and I kind of just went with the flow because it wasn't my fire.
Right.
What I think really should have been done is that we should have just kind of put a timeout. I should have got with the other chief and said, listen, this is what I see. I see heavy fire. I see dead hydrants. I see gypsum roof, you know, steel bar, lightweight construction, and these are all pointing in a bad direction. And subsequently, the building did collapse, you know. It took like a half hour, but it did collapse, you know. So,
sounds like it was a good thing you trusted your gut enough to at least talk about it.
Yeah, it was, you know. So, you know, it's an interesting profession, firefighting, you know, because, you know, we have a lot of downtime. I mean, we do have a lot of downtime, and, you know, you could be in that firehouse for 23 hours, and you could be twiddling your thumbs, you know, but within a minute, the whole world can change, you know, and
right.
And that always amazed me about the fire service, is that it's just, there's no givens, there's no, we don't, we don't arrange for fires to happen. Like, they happen whenever. You know, and we have
well,
to
you
be...
Well, we have SOPs, and they're helpful, but they only give you a little bit of guidance, and you have to learn to do the right kind of size up to give you good situation awareness so you can make that tough decision sooner rather than later.
Exactly. So, you know, as far as now being into the fire, you know, going back to that vacant building fire, you know, we talk about slides, and it's kind of, I wrote about this too in an article that'll be coming out in January on the website for fire engineering. But, you know, I didn't even, you know, I haven't thought about this fire in forever. And as soon as we pulled up on the scene, I had this instant memory of this chief one time ordering us not to stop forcing entry. It was the same exact building. It was a three-story frame. And he was very insistent. It was not a popular decision because guys were like, you know, come on, chief, you know, we could do it. You know, we got it. And he was very insistent. He's like, no, everybody out, set up the towel ladder. And I was in the towel ladder, and I was grumbling, you know. I was like, God damn, this freaking jackass, you know, screw him. And, you know, now we got to dump water on this thing. And I would say, I don't know, after we knocked down most of the fire with the towel ladder, you know, I'm in the bucket and I'm overhauling the cornice and pulling the cornice and trim and all kinds of stuff. And I look at the guy, my partner, I'm like, why did you move the bucket? He says, I didn't move the bucket. He says, and I looked and realized the building just collapsed.
The building moved instead of the bucket, huh? You know, I remember that too. I was an engine captain in the 70s. And at that time, we didn't write off building. And occasionally there would be a chief that would think like your chief and say, you know what, there's no life inside this building, and I'm not going to risk firefighters' lives to save some property. And it wasn't a popular decision, but that's what being an incident commander is about, is making those tough decisions.
Exactly. I mean, there's an old joke that – they talk about in my old firehouse that it's almost like a cliche. The engine boss was in there and the guys were in there and they're putting out all this fire and the chief's outside and he's like, okay, guys, time's up. You know, let's pull it out. We're going to set up the towel ladders. And they're fighting back and forth now. And the engine officer was like, No, we got it, and back and forth, and finally the chief says, he goes in, he drags them out, and there was five floors of fire, you know, and that was just the mindset back then, you know,
and that's why we need one guy in charge, or I should say one guy or gal. Now we have some women incident commanders, but you do need one person in charge that has the authority to say, we're not going to talk about this, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah. I know it's tough. I mean, I was guilty of it myself one time. I was working, we had a good fire in a brownstone, and, you know, we were making great progress on the fire, and we just put out the second floor when I was moving up to do the third floor, and the chief, you know, he orders us out, everyone out, and we were MF, you know, cursing up a storm, and, you know, that was his call. I mean, we have to respect it. That's the whole thing, is that, you know, we don't have time for a discussion when that decision's made. And I feel that's the toughest decision a battalion chief has to make, or an incident command has to make, is when to pull the plug.
In some cases, it's not that tough because it's as obvious as you described in your other fire. But when there's a lot of value there or the possibility of life, that is the toughest decision.
Yeah. So, before we get going, I think we have to take a commercial break. So bear with me for a second. I think we have I got to play a clip from our sponsor, Granger, and if I could find it, because I know they just changed all these clips. So if you give me a second. Man, there is so many
on
here.
I got all night. I love talking about leadership and fire stuff, so
I'll be here as long as you can talk.
Give me 15 seconds. We're going to now hear from our sponsor, Grainger.
The 4,600-page Grainger catalog. Every solution on earth for every problem under the sun. And now, it fits in your pocket. Download the app today. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Grainger.com, or stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, thank you, Grainger. Okay, Gary, we're back. That was a quick spot.
That was quick.
It was quick. So,
This is my first time of doing one of these call-in discussions, and you're being a good host. It's making it easy for me to talk.
Oh, thanks, Gary. So listen, I want to change focus for a second. I had another incident that I wanted to talk about, and again, it was an incident where I was the safety chief, not so much the first two battalion chief, and I was coming in on a second alarm. The fire was in a three-story occupied private dwelling, or multiple dwelling rather. And you know, the funny thing about this fire is that, again, I had this great advantage of coming in like after the fact. So, you know, the first two units were on scene, the chief's on scene, the all hands chief is there, and they're operating. And, you know, once you start operating, you get in a mode and you see, once you start seeing things, you don't see the other stuff unless you take a step back, and it's very hard to do that in a fire. So as a safety chief, I think this is something that we do very well, and I think it's very important. We don't have a safety chief per se on an all-hands fire. We only have them for a second alarm or better. So when I was coming in, I was listening to the radio, and I was getting a good size up, and I was getting a really good picture of what was going on. And it was a good fire in a basement, and we had exposure issues on the D side. So, but the first thing that struck me as I rolled into the scene, I got out of my car, I walked up to the scene because all the units are there, and this building looked out of place. And what I mean by that is that the whole block was two-story private dwellings. And in the middle of the block, there was this, it looked like an albatross. It was just a three-story, brand-new construction, multiple dwelling, right? So I got on scene, I reported into the deputy chief, and the first question I asked him is, I said, chief, I said, do we know if this is lightweight construction or dimensional lumber? And no one had asked that question at that point. So immediately,
you know, that is the main reason that the incident commander needs a safety chief or a safety officer, because the normal officers who are attacking are really into the tactics and the problems are seen, and the safety chief has the ability to stand back and get the whole big picture and think about things like, I wonder if they know about lightweight construction in this building or not. And just by you asking that question caused a thought, I would guess.
Right. But, you know what's kind of funny is that for me it was so obvious because, you know, I'm coming in now and, you know, I don't get involved in the operation as a safety chief. I am totally there for the guys, you know, for the firefighters. And, the first thought, it was like a naturalistic decision. And why I'm bringing it up, though, is that I don't have any slides about lightweight construction. I don't have any fires under my belt. A real good, you know, first-hand lightweight construction fire. I mean, I've been hearing about it, I don't know, for how long now? For a few years, this is a very hot, you know, hot-button item. But, you know, honestly, I can't say that I really had a good fire in a lightweight, but you know, I kind of built a slide out of just training and reading and listening to lectures and whatever SOPs we have now or whatever's written in our books. And I kind of coupled that with the amount of fire that was in this structure at the time. And I even though I don't have a first-hand slide, I was kind of able to cobble together a slide. Does that make sense?
Yeah, in fact, I'd like to spend a minute to reinforce that concept you just talked about, because I know from my own experience that you can create what we in mission-centered solution call partial slides. The experience slides are the best because they're the most vivid and they're right on the top of your subconscious thinking. But you can make partial slides from study and planning and using your imagination. So when lightweight construction was new for me as a battalion commander, I studied until I understood the problems with lightweight construction. And then I looked at buildings and I imagined that it would be a lightweight construction and say, what would be my strategy to still attack the fire, because I didn't want to write it off because it was lightweight construction, but I could attack the fire from a relatively safe position and save half the building without exposing my people to the possible collapse. And I did all of that in my imagination. And then when I had a fire in one of those buildings, I had slides almost as good as experience slides.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, kudos to the first two units at that fire, because the first two engine, which is one of the units in my battalion, actually, they were encountered with a heavy fire conditioner in the basement. They had a dead hydrant in front of the building. They had fire blowing out of the windows in the basement, and it ignited a car that was in a driveway, which in turn was fully involved, which ignited the house next door. So they were on scene by themselves with a dead hydrant, and they were able to keep the fire out of the exposure, put the car fire out, and then put the basement fire out. So kudos to,
well,
to
was
that.
Was it in fact a lightweight construction building?
Well, here's what happened. So when I asked the question, the chief told me, he says, okay, Danny, go ahead and get on that. So I immediately went onto the first floor, and I caught the rescue company. They were working on the floor above, and I immediately asked the question, and they started opening up. And the first answer I got was yes, indeed it was lightweight. But then I heard from another company saying that it wasn't lightweight, and what had happened was it was a kind of a hybrid building. But nevertheless, there were some serious issues at this fire. The other issue was, which guys don't think about, and I thought about it afterwards. There was a the fire was going up into the eaves, and had it burned through the eaves, it would have got into the truss, which was in the roof, the attic space. So,
right. So anyway, the fire did not penetrate the ceiling from inside. Is that right?
No, it didn't. It did a little bit, but not exactly.
But not enough to really to cause a truss failure.
No, thankfully no. So anyway, Gary, I'm going to put you on hold. I don't know how to do this, but I have another call. I have a feeling it might be Bobby. I'm going to put you on hold for one second, and
sure.
I'm going to try to cobble my way.
Do you think?
Sorry?
Will I be able to hear that conversation?
I hope so. This is all new to me. Give me a second. I'm going to put you on hold.
Okay, way new to me.
Okay, hold on.
Okay. It's your show, Danny.
Okay. Bobby? Hello? Oh, hello? Hi,
Danny?
Bobby?
Yeah, I'm right here, buddy.
Yeah, this is all new to me. I don't know if Gary could hear me now. Can I listen to two people at one time?
You can have four or five people on at the same time.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
Gary,
I'm
you there?
I'm hearing both of you. Yeah, I hear both of you now.
Cool.
So it's like a conference call.
Hey,
oh,
buddy,
this is beautiful.
We're dragging you kicking and screaming into the roaring 90s. Conference call.
Okay.
Hey, Gary, how are you?
I'm doing great. Nice to meet you, even if it is only on the phone.
Yeah.
Okay, so
Danny has if we're in a three-way conversation, Danny told me about your whole production, and he has this idea of discussing East Coast, West Coast things and where they're the same and where they're different. And, I travel here about six times a year, so I hope I get to meet you sometime, Bobby.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah. I think that on the East Coast and the West Coast, the only thing that's different is that they get to wear shorts a lot more than we do.
Yeah.
I think there's some differences just because they have a lot of staffing issues, but in the major departments, like if you go to LA City, they're indistinguishable from every other metropolitan city on the East Coast, the larger cities. It's the fire problems, some of the wildman stuff is, you know, more nuanced than some of the East Coast people are refined to, but by and large, structural firefighting is pretty much the same, more or less. Maybe some different terminology here and there, but you know,
yeah. And in cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco, the age of those buildings is very similar to the age of your buildings.
Yeah, you get down the Tenderloin District, you get down in, you know, down Studio City, the older parts of L.A. You know, you could just as easily be, you know, in Brooklyn, Bronx, real similar.
Yeah. The thing that I noticed, I worked for L.A. County Fire, and so most of our buildings are not as old as those in L.A. City. But the thing that we have rarely see in Southern California is cellars and basements with fire in them.
That's true. Mostly slab built out there, right?
Yeah, right.
So, Gary, you shouldn't be so modest. You should tell Bobby what your nickname was. Was it the father something or other? I can't remember now.
I don't want to talk about that. Everybody can hear about it.
Bobby, Gary has a very good wildland fire background.
Right. I'm pretty familiar with that. And then I think that the refinement, especially of wildland firefighting, when you look at, you know, the teams, and I had the great pleasure of working with Tim Sexton and the Great Basin team, you know, that level of refinement to a specific type of firefighting is amazing when you watch it, you know, unfold. It's amazing. But a lot of people don't
understand.
Yeah,
I really believe in the value of teams. And I was involved with the federal teams, and I helped L.A. County develop some of their teams. And I really encourage the teams that are being done by urban areas now, like here in New York City, they have their teams. And that's what we're here this week. MCS is helping the New York City Incident Management Team add some skills to their toolbox.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, so. And I think the experience is invaluable. And one of the things when you go to a campaign fire, when you look at the long range planning and then the day to day planning, you know how you take information and make it useful data that you can build a plan off of is really a great experience. I enjoyed that part of it. I always liked hearing the brief in the morning and then, you know, watching the updates come through during the day, you know, which always impressed me, which is something we don't get to do a lot. Structural firefighting tends to be, as you know, Gary, much more episodic. You know, it's fast. It's, you know, it's furious, and it doesn't go like a wildland would go for, you know, sometimes weeks. You know, you don't get that opportunity for that in-depth analysis. It's more, you know, reactionary.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, Bobby, it was funny. I was on two wildland fires with the IMT, and I got a lot of strange looks when I was out in Oregon and Idaho, and I was actually, in essence, working as a division supervisor, a div soup, as they call them. And wow, that was an eye opener. I spent, in total a month, two-week assignments, and I gained a very healthy respect for the wildland guys. I kind of likened it like a marathon as opposed to like a 100-yard dash, you know? Like the,
yeah,
the,
yeah, and both of them are art forms that require discipline, skill, training, talent. I mean, you know, if you look at somebody who really knows how to run a 100-yard dash or a 50-yard dash, they train just as diligently as the people that run 26 miles and beyond this. So, you know, both skill sets are highly respectable and admirable, but they're somewhat more nuanced. And fire behavior, which is interesting because I think on the structural side, we've just really started to look at fire behavior, I think over the last 40 years, you know, whereas the wildland guys have been probably doing it for the last 80, you know, realistically, the U.S. Forest Service has got a good history of studying the fire behavior, whereas we just really, I think you'd have to probably look at Clark and Freed to say they were kind of the firemen that kind of lit the interest in actual fire behavior, as it were, especially Clark. I mean, he was really something in the amount of study that he put into watching fire and from a structural standpoint, whereas, you know, you go back to Manning and the people like that in the wildland that, you know, wrote volumes on it, you know, 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago.
Right. I think something Gary just said is pretty pertinent, though. And I would say, I mean, we don't really experience it here in New York. And, you know, in the capacity in which we're going to perform is a guest. But what I noticed out west and in these other areas is that people are building houses in places where we never built them before. And I could see absolutely, like, some sort of benefit to having the structural knowledge and also having the wildland knowledge and kind of coupling together and make a hybrid team, you know? I wonder if that's coming down the road in America.
Well, you know, that's what I really encourage. I was involved in some of the federal planning to go to what they now call all-hazard incident management teams. And, you know, they have an association now that promotes that throughout the country. And, you know, we were doing the contrast between the short-duration structure fire and the two-month-long wildfire. But in my experience, having done both of those, command skills are what is needed in both cases. So you need some command skills to run the sprint, and you need some command skills to run the long race. And those all-hazard incident management teams are doing that. And that's what we're talking about this week with the New York incident management teams. And what I call the most difficult challenge in the scenario we're presenting is what I call information management. How do you get, you know, in a structure fire, you have to do it really quick and make some decisions really quick. In the wildfire, you do it in 12 or 24-hour cycles over the long run, and it continues to get better and better and better. But that mid-ground, say a hazmat incident or an earthquake that lasts 3 days, you need some command skills that are mid-ground on that.
Exactly. You know what I found, Gary, with the little experience I had in the wildland is that planning ops is a key component where, you know, you have to really look at that next 24 hours. It's not like, you know, I'm at a structural fire and I need a second alarm. I just pick up the phone, a radio handset, and I call for a second alarm, and I have guys there in 4 minutes. If you need a few bulldozers or another team, or, you know, it's not going to be there, you know, in the next hour. It's, you know, it's going to take a while, right?
Right. You have to be more patient with those long-range incidents.
Right. Yeah, that's well, the one thing I did notice about the planning ops. I thought it was pretty cool. It's just like trying to do that board, set up the board for the next cycle. You know, trying to figure out what's needed.
Teams,
no?
Most of the teams that I'm familiar with, they all use planning ops now. It's an excellent position on the team.
Right.
I think if we look at it though, there's two separate questions, and I think Gary raises some interesting, you know, questions. And I think if we, one of the things I think in the fire service that we've done, and the wildland companies that go out, and let me just be very clear on this, because I had the great pleasure of working with the Gonzo team back in the 70s in the Cibola National Forest, and that was in the early days of the Gonzo helitack teams. And then when I was working for the U.S. Department of Forestry out there in New Mexico, and so I had some wildland early experience, and then I had some structural, you know, tons of structural stuff after that. But I think that what's interesting, and I think we devote a lot of energy into the first and greater portion of training in the wildland, and then establishing the conditions that we're going to be working under, looking for desired outcomes, rather than the structural side that since the 80s has been devoting a tremendous amount of energy into the online process management and the art of being a good incident commander. So I think what the structural side since the 80s has gotten away from is devoting a tremendous amount of energy into training teams into performing under established conditions, looking for desired outcomes. We've become very myopically reliant on the incident commander and kind of that online process management at the back end. I think, and albeit important, I'm not saying we should stop doing that, but we need to go back to that team building. If you look at those teams that come to a wildland incident, they're, whether it's the Rocky Mountain team or, you know, they're independent contractors who have people who, in many instances, who are highly, highly skilled, with the exception of, you know, Cal Fire and teams from that organization. But many of these teams are privately run, highly skilled, highly drilled, highly efficient, and with incredibly deep relationships. I mean, you know, long-term, hardcore relationships. On the structural side, you can have a team of people who met each other that morning at roll call or who have some vague associations and limited associations and don't have that depth of understanding of one another or the skill set. So I think that, you know, in order to be successful, we need to look at those two phases. And I think if we start to put a lot more energy into the first and greater portion of training and establishing conditions that, you know, in other words, tactics, which we're starting to do today. We're going back to what we used to do in the 40s and 50s, where we coordinated ventilation and fire attack much more tightly. I mean, you know, I've got the great privilege of being able to read the old texts. They're all in my office and all the magazines back to the 1800s. We drifted away from that, and now you're seeing people starting to rediscover that value, and I think that's going to have tremendous impact, and I think there's a lot we can learn from our wildland brothers and sisters who didn't experience that drift. They continued to invest their energies almost equally, but clearly they understand, you know, working on conditions for desired outcomes, and you have to appreciate that. I think as a student of the game.
Right.
Yeah, one of the things that I've noticed about that is the dedicated teams. You know, assuming they stay together with just a little bit of attrition, they get better year after year. And if they're just focusing on wildfires or dealing with one kind of emergency, and they get really good at it, it's a little bit of a challenge when they have to do an all-hazard thing. Your ops chief may not be familiar with one type of a discipline or the other. And I think that it's important to have what I call rapid team building. If you put together a team today to deal with an incident tomorrow, you still have some time to do some team building with some of the outcomes that the great teams have.
Hey Bobby, just to pick up on what Gary's saying, just from my perspective, and I could see it because I've seen it over the almost now 30 years, but what you're saying, I noticed when I first came on a job, when we were much busier, we were much more of a cohesive team, you know, especially when I was in the squad. But do you think complacency and all this downtime may be playing into that?
Yeah, idle hands. You know, they say idle hands are the devil's playground, and part of that saying comes from the fact that people who don't have an appreciation for the risks they face or for the demands they might be placed under tend to discount that danger. You know, men who face it every day get very proficient, you know, and men and women who, you know, and I'm just using the term loosely there, but the men and women who face it every day become much more aware and therefore put greater value in the time that they can invest into practice and refinement. So I think it's interesting. You know, it's interesting what Gary said about teams, too, the people that can stay together. It reminds me of what Henri de Pique said. He was a French general in the 1800s, and he said, poor brave men who do not know each other well will not dare attack a lion, but four less brave who know each other well, therefore assured of mutual aid, will attack resolutely. And what he was saying was that it's important that teams have time to bond and gel in order to be effective. And we're losing that on the structural side. I mean, you used to get assigned to a company and, you'd work with the guys for pretty much uninterrupted for 4 or 5 years. Now there's so much floating, so much movement, and I think that hurts the integrity, it hurts the functionality of the team.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we talk about in the mission-centered solution, we teach team building in each one of our classes because we think it's really important whether you're building a 5-member engine company team or a 20-member incident command team. All the work you do on team building, it makes the team stronger. And somebody mentioned, one of you mentioned earlier, complacency tears that down. So that's the leader's challenge. When you get your team built up, you can't back off. You have to continue to build your team. And then what I said earlier, you can do the same thing in one day. Like I used to be a captain in a high-rise district, and in L.A. County, we didn't have much of that. So on a regular basis, I'd get one new team member on my high-rise engine company. So the first thing I did in the morning after we were ready to go, we did some team building. So that person knew who we were and how we operated, and we incorporated that person into a one-day team building assignment.
Exactly.
That's a great idea.
Hey, Bobby, if you guys don't mind, I know you have to pay some bills, so I'm going to run this quick ad from Granger, and we'll be back in about 15 seconds.
Hey, love it.
With over 100,000 safety products, it makes me wonder, did Granger write the book on workplace safety? Get your copy today. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Granger.com, or stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, thank you, Granger. Okay, Bobby, sorry to cut you off.
No, you don't be sorry at all. I love Granger. I think it's
no.
Trust me.
The bills, right?
They do help me pay the bills.
Right. One of my observations on the wildland, it was kind of ironic, this FDNY guy at the time, a battalion chief running with this crew. But Gary was saying is that, and you were saying, was that, they show up on scene and they got to put in a line and they got to cut trees and they got to clear brush. These guys are working 13, 14 hours unimpeded, nonstop, And the work is constant for them. After 2 weeks, these guys, you could carry them off with a stretcher, And I absolutely agree with you. That builds a real tight, close-knit, bonded team, when you work that closely together with someone for 2 weeks, I felt this after being with these guys for 2 weeks, almost like part of the team as well. Like, I got to know them so well.
Well, I think that it probably cuts both ways. Guys want to, they probably respected, your experience in New York as much as you respected theirs. And, work is an interesting thing. And Gary has the unique perspective of having been, involved at all levels on both sides, the wildland and the structural. I feel like the old Roy Benson. I like both kinds of music, country and western.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Yeah, I like
yeah, it's still firefighting, but we talk about it. But Gary, I don't know if you remember this, and I know Danny, you will. We had there were some fires out on Long Island and Staten Island. Gosh, was it about 6-7 years back, Danny? And,
right.
And those were as good a wildland fire as you want to get to. They were some pretty good wildland fires. But what was interesting was how woefully unprepared the New York Long Island area was. The guys were all out there in their bunker gear. Nobody had the right tools. Terrible stuff.
Not many Pulaskis in the FDNY.
No.
Hey, next time I come, I'll bring one.
There you go.
They wouldn't know what to do with a Pulaski. honestly, I have to say, though, to defend myself, though, I knew I couldn't add anything from the fire end on the wildland, but I felt that the times I worked, I was contributing because I was pretty good at organizing the division and working with the people. I felt that it was one of my strengths. And the other strength that I felt that I had was we were tasked with protecting, it was like a group of homes. And I felt that my experience in structural firefighting, I saw things that those guys didn't see. Like, for example, there were propane tanks on the decks. There was eaves that were exposed. All this structural stuff. And, you know, the wildland guys really didn't have that in-depth knowledge. And I always felt after that experience that there's definitely some kind of room for a hybrid team that, you know, and I'm sure L.A. is all over that with the, because they do both. Like, Gary, I'm sure that's in your purview, right?
Yeah, most of the Southern California wildfire and urban agencies, they do build hybrid teams to be able to handle that. And one of the things I'd like to add on to what you just said, structural firefighters know how to protect exposures, right? So it's
exactly
the same thing. You have an exposure from vegetation instead of another structure.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So.
Well, I think, in most of the western cities, you know, if you take Denver, Albuquerque, Colorado Springs, all of those firefighters are red card and, you know, and structurally certified. And that was kind of the real concept behind the blue card idea was exactly that. And where it came out of, I don't know if you ever heard this story, Gary, but I was running Albuquerque at the time operations, so the ops chief, and I get this bosque fire, which is a Spanish word for riverbed, but it was a wildland fire within the city limits, 19 miles, good fire, goes for 2 days, you know, good 95 degrees, 25 mile an hour winds, you know, middle of the, I think it was in July. So anyway, our guys did a great job. We had plenty of red-carded guys. But after fighting a wildland fire like that for 42, 72 hours, we didn't have a man left who hadn't, you know, outperformed Herculean effort, but they were exhausted. So we were having problems. So we call in a Type 1 overhead team, and we get a team that comes in, good team, and nice people. But I commented that what I really needed was structural guys. I needed, at the time I called them blue card guys, and Brunicini picked up on it, and he said, what do you mean by blue card? I said, I mean, you know, it's structural guys that can let the Albuquerque guys take a blow, because even all our mutual aid people, I mean, we had people from as far away as Colorado Springs come down to help us. We were done. We'd won the race. We were done. We didn't have anybody to staff, and that's where the whole idea for that came from. But if you go out west, Danny, seriously, west of the Missouri River, most of those departments, wear both hats pretty seamlessly, do a wonderful job. L.A. County, obviously, the epitome of the refinement of that, Gary, is that, you take how you guys handle it with your helitack crews that are, stationed throughout the mountains, and I had the great pleasure, I can't remember what the station's name is, Gary, you might be able to, the hotshot crew that's out there in the Malibu Hills.
We call them camps. The one in Malibu is Camp 8.
Okay.
And,
Camp 8,
I want to thank you for that compliment. Even though I'm retired, I'm still proud to be a former member of L.A. County Fire. And, funny, when I first started, everybody said, these wind-driven wildfires happen all the time in California. And so California was the place to have those. But we've seen in recent years they happen just about everywhere, don't they?
Sure. And we're developing a great appreciation for wind-driven fires in the structural arena as well. I mean, you look at some of the recent fatalities from Montgomery County, Houston, there were wind-driven events that claim the lives of structural firefighters. So it's a...
True.
And we've gotten away from that. I think, again, if you go back to the 80s, we drifted away from really factoring the weather into our size-ups for a myriad of reasons, bunker gear. And complacency is an interesting word. I mean, you can be complacent because you think you know it all, you've been to everything, and you know, you don't need to learn anymore, or you can be complacent because you just don't know what you don't know. So,
yeah.
I lose you guys? You there, Bobby?
Yeah, right here.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's one of the, that's the, you know, in a 13-point size up, coal was wealth. That's one of the W's is weather. And that's becoming more and more of a factor, right, in the, in our structural world is the wind.
Well, it was really before the 80s. 80s was kind of like the lost decade. I don't know where we went, but, you know, we went in an interesting direction. But, you know, it's back with a vengeance. But, you know, the wild land guys live and die by weather, literally.
Yeah.
One of the things I noticed during that era, that was the era of new challenges for fire departments. Prior to that, we did fires and a little bit of EMS stuff. But then we got into ALS and we got into hazmat and all these other disciplines that has mandated training. And so the focus of a typical fire company is pulled in many different directions. So it's hard to maintain all those skills.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot on the guys' plates now, especially with building inspection and training and, you know, a day tour now in a firehouse, there's absolutely no downtime anymore on a day tour, you know. And you're right, we're wearing a lot of hats now. But, you know, that's the direction that the world has pointed us in, especially here in the Big Apple, right, in New York City. I mean, we're like still have that big target on our our city, you know?
You know, Barry and Danny, I think that, you know, we talk about in the fire service, but I think that's true of workers everywhere. You know, people just, our skill sets continue to expand, and, you know, very few people are one-trick ponies anymore. There's nobody on the assembly line putting, you know, right-hand doors on Camaros. You know, there's a machine doing it, and you need to know how to maintenance that machine and the hydraulics that go into it and the process behind it. And, you know, the worker today, whether it's, you know, public or private sector, has to be multifaceted. The era of, you know, of being, you know, of having one tool in your toolbox is long gone. I mean, if you go out to one of those camps, as Gary was talking about, that L.A. County has, you know, just developed to a refinement, that helicopter would take off 1 minute on a suspected fire with a crew of 13, 15 guys in the back of that helicopter, and they're flying those MH-60s, those beautiful machines. And, you know, he'll land two minutes later, he's taken off with a medic or two medics, and they're taking care of a heart attack at one of these houses that Danny was talking about that are built up into the hills there. And in those homes, and Gary, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but many of those homes have been there for 50 years. So, you know, to us on the East Coast, it might seem like a new thing that people are living in the woods, but for Californians, it's been a way of life for probably for forever.
Yeah, I think the only difference is, you know, we have what we call fire corridors, where historic fires travel through because of the wind patterns and the canyons. The difference now is when I was a young firefighter, there were a few hundred structures out there. Now there's thousands of structures out there. So when a fire goes through there, there's many more challenges to protect them all.
Isn't it Pepperdine that's built right in? Isn't that the college that's built right into the hills there, Gary? Isn't it Pepperdine that's built right into the?
Pepperdine. That when I was a battalion commander, I spent 5 years there along the Malibu coast, and Pepperdine is a very nice college. And actually, they're very cooperative. They let us use it as an incident base for our regular wind-driven fires.
Right, and it's right off one of those paths. I remember reading about it and the construction features and how they tried to build, you know, defensible space around it. But, you know, when you look at the topography and the canyons and the chutes that surround that facility, that's a fascinating That's a fascinating study on construction, you know, fire history, cooperation between the L.A. County Fire Department and the folks who built that incredibly beautiful campus. I mean, just breathtaking campus. But everything there was built with a purpose. Beautiful.
And it was designed with fire in mind. They knew the fire would come through there. And during my career, I've been on 3 fires that burned around Pepperdine and never lost a structure there.
Wow. Well, so you know, there's another great adage. I mean, I love the old sayings. There's the ounce of prevention right there.
You're right. I agree.
You know, there's the ounce of prevention. And you know, tremendous wisdom that was portrayed by, you know, our grandfathers that, because Pepperdine's been around for a long time, you know, and it's always had that knowledge that it's in a high-risk area. And being true Americans, that they made the choice to be there, but they accepted the responsibility that came along with it. They never shirked the responsibility of having to build with a sense of the dangers they risked of fire, and they were so responsible about it. I just, my wife, you know, we toured around there, and she's like, "Really? You're amazed by the fire protection?" She's amazed by the beauty of the place, and I'm like, "No, you have to."
Yeah, you know, in my mind, that's a classic example of architects, builders, and public service working together to make something that is fire safe, and yet it's still aesthetically pleasing.
Right, and environmentally pleasing, and everything about it, and it's not. Much of it is new and beautiful, but much of it's been there, and again, I'm not exactly sure the dates of Pepperdine, but I think it's been there since the 20s and 30s. I mean,
Pepperdine was in the L.A. area at that time, but I'm not sure exactly when it was built, but I think it was built in the 70s in Malibu.
Okay. I'm sure there's some kid out there right now Googling it.
Right. Exactly.
You notice that in your classes these days, Gary, you'll say something and you say, "I'm not sure, but I think about," and some kid will raise his hand and say, "Hey, Bobby, actually it was, you know, 1955 or whatever." Okay,
Bobby, I did that in Gary's class, by the way. I did Google something.
Oh, no.
Well, I got to kick out one comment from Bobby earlier. He was talking about reading some notable fire experts from 1850. I thought I'd gone back to read Lloyd Lehman. Well, I thought that was an old-time study.
Lloyd's got some interesting stuff. You know, the little drops of water, and you know, if you read it in context, I think what happened, unfortunately, was that a lot of people read Lloyd out of context. And he was, you know, from his Navy career, he was used to, you know, compartmentalized fires where you could literally, you know, trap the steam in a compartment. And the problem is in the structural application, a lot of people found was that the compartments weren't sealed tight enough to get the effect that he was hoping for. And like with any theory, you know, people, you can shoot holes in anything, but there's a lot of good stuff in there and a lot of stuff that's still applicable today. And you know, I love, you know, Gary, if you ever get the chance and you come up to our offices up here, and we're right up here in Fairlawn, New Jersey, but I've got, you know, fire journals that go back to 1863. And, you know, when you read them, it's for me, it's a joy. I mean, I could do it day in and day out. But whenever I'm in the office, I try to pull down, you know, a volume from 22 or 35 or 55 or whenever, just to see what was going on, but also to see what foundations were being laid. You know, what I mean? for us, and what foundations are we laying? You know, for firefighters in the future. And the one theme that always, I think, for me, resonates in all of the writers that in the fire service is that insatiable curiosity, you know what I mean, that and that willingness to question, you know, and say, okay, you know, it's like we were the kids who our parents gave radios when we were younger, and we took them apart. Yeah, I remember my dad coming to my room, and there's this radio he'd given me apart on my desk, and I'm trying to put it back together. He goes, "Why'd you do that?"
I don't know, Dad. I want to see how it worked.
Hey, Bobby, I wanted to touch on something. Maybe we'll wrap it up with this, but you mentioned about, you know, everyone multitasking and doing different jobs. And I was last year, I took a trip to Munich with my cousin, and I had some downtime. So I went over by, you know, where they have the Oktoberfest, you know, the tents.
Sure.
That area there, well, there's a firehouse right down the block. And I spent like a few hours with them, you know, and just watching. I was very impressed. They have, I guess, a million people in Munich. And they have 10 stations, and their station is huge, though. I mean, there was probably about 8 or 9 pieces of apparatus in there. And the way they work, there's 25 guys on shift, and I think there's, like the FDNY, I think there's 4 shifts. And what you do, when you're assigned to that fire station, okay, you do every job in that station. So, like, they do dispatching out of there, they do helicopter, medics, car accidents, hazmat, you name it, they do it. And you're not, like, in my department, you're assigned to a truck company, that's it. That's the only hat you're going to wear for most of the time. But from what I understood, they have a great ICS. You know, they have a leader, and then they have sub-leaders and all, whatever they call them. But you could come in on any given day, and even mid-shift, you could be switched from dispatch to being on the truck company. And the next tour you come in, you're on a helicopter. And everyone does everyone's job. And I was impressed by that. I was just wondering, do you think it's better to be well-rounded and do everything, or do you think we should have guys just doing specific jobs, you know?
Well, I don't know. And I'd like to let Gary has to think on it also. I think being an American, I'm a little more familiar with our system where people get a skill level at a particular assignment, and I'm more in favor of people spending time and teams being together than people just moving that frequently between jobs and assignments. So I would have to say that I think that I'm more inclined to say that I think for skill building and team building is probably a little more advantage to people staying together on a company and refining their skills. But I also think that it probably makes sense to do, well, like you have and like Lieutenant McCormick is doing right now. You know, Ray forever was on a truck, but now he's on an engine. And, you know, he wants to learn that skill. He wants to understand that side of the game. That's a true student of the art. You know, that's a person who, you know, like yourself and many other, you know, storied FDNY people and storied L.A. County folks and L.A. City folks, and, you know, they don't want to be one-dimensional. They want to know the medical side. They want to know the ladder side, the truck side. But that being said, the other thing that's interesting to note on the German system is although it's a much smaller country than the United States, I think they only have, I'm not sure, but I believe it's just about 25 or 30 million folks. They have 1.2 million volunteer firefighters in the nation of Germany. Which is pretty impressive.
Oh, really?
And I think that we have about the same number of volunteers in the United States. And so a much smaller country, but they have a huge volunteer fire service. Very active, also, by the way. Very active. What are your thoughts on that, Gary?
I really like specialization. I like to see a company that is excellent at what they do, whether that's a ladder company or a rescue company, or now, you know, there's so much of heavy rescue with building collapses and things like that, and that requires a lot of training, and I like to see that kind of specialization trained at a very high level. But I also really believe in the cross-training that Danny talked about. I did that as a battalion commander. In L.A. County, we didn't have enough ladder companies, so I would have to wait for a second ladder company on many of my fires. So I had all of my engine companies could do all of the roof functions. And they weren't as good as a ladder company, but they were cross-trained to do an acceptable job.
Right. Yeah. Well, what's normal, like, in my job is that if we have a shortage in a truck company or an engine company, you know, we'll hire guys on overtime, or they'll get detailed. And so many times, like actually today in one of my engine companies, the whole back step was truckies, you know, and I thought it was pretty interesting, you know. So it's just, I thought it was interesting, you know, being in Germany and that, you know, they're so high tech. But I got the impression while I was there that I didn't see a lot of fire pictures on the wall. I think fires are not very common in Munich, Germany. So,
well, if you look at the building construction in Germany, Danny, one of the things to remember is that that most of it is done with block, and not a lot of stick building there, because
right.
they just don't have the resources. Now they're importing a lot of lumber from the United States, and they're doing more stick, mostly in standalone commercial, not a great amount of residential. So they are used to compartmentalization to a much greater degree than we are in terms of their fire behavior. Also their codes, you know, 1 hour, their fire ratings are a lot more strictly enforced than ours are. And so in that regard, you know, their fire incidence is probably not that much lower, but the incidence of it traveling from compartment to compartment is much less because of the construction features.
Right.
And I just know that from hanging out there and running some conferences there. You know, we, fire engineering, we used to do some conferences in Cologne and around in Germany, and got to ride out with a lot of those guys. So the fires I saw were kind of like, you know, a lot of H&R buildings that were built circa 1950, you know, 50s and 60s in New York. A lot of that. There's a lot of that. Not as high and as deep, but, you know, scale that down to, you know, 6 stories, 5 stories, and you probably saw a lot of that when you were there.
Yeah. So, it was interesting. I've never seen anything like that before, and I just thought it was interesting. So.
Yeah, that's
so anyways, well, Gary, I'm glad you got to meet Bobby. It's been great having you on. And Bobby, I think Gary and I will be doing this a lot more in the future. I'd like to.
I love it. East and West.
I really enjoyed this. I wasn't sure how well the conversation could go back and forth, but I thought it went very well.
Yeah, and you know, it'll be fun, you guys. We get some time, and Gary, I'll shoot you a note. We'll join a Google Hangout with Danny, and we'll take it to the video segment. The guys really kind of dig that, and people can send in questions off of Google Hangout. So we'll schedule one of those in the future too. It's just another way to reach the folks, and the folks to reach you. And I know a lot about you, having never met you before. Kind of interesting, as much as the two of us have been around, that we've never bumped into each other before, you know. So,
yeah, it sounds like we have crossed paths in a few places.
Yeah. Well, we're
so thank you for that
generation.
Invitation. I would like to get closer involved with fire engineering.
Yeah, we'd love to have you. We would absolutely be thrilled. I don't know if you know, but a good friend of yours is going to get the Lifetime Achievement Award at FDIC this year. We run that show, Ronnie Coleman. So,
Ronnie Coleman?
Yeah, he's going to accept our Lifetime Achievement Award for 2014. So,
yeah, he's one of my heroes.
Oh, I love that man. He's such a joy, and he's done so much for the fire service. And such a humble and virtuous man, and I think well deserving of the Lifetime Achievement Award for sure.
Lovely man.
So we would love to have you write and speak and participate in all that we're doing. Your knowledge and your experience is, you know, unparalleled, and it would be great to have you.
Thank you. I'll look forward to that.
Sounds like a plan. So, Bobby, let me pay one more bill here. I'm going to run our last commercial, and then we'll say goodbye. Hold on.
When we put out fires, it ain't the metaphor kind, kid. That's why I use Granger. They got everything. They got Bullard helmets, Cosmos boots, Elkhart brass nozzles. And on top of it all, Grainger's got the inventory management solutions to keep the heat off the books. Heck, they've got just about everything you need for the fire station except the trucks. When you think fire rescue, you think Grainger. Get it? Got it? Good. Call, click Grainger.com/public safety or stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Got it. Got it.
I love that. I love that commercial. That's a good
got
commercial.
It. And that's I a, got it.
Gary,
all right.
That's an interesting company, Gary. If those guys had been around when you and I were running jobs and you know trying to manage, they do just a quick shout out to these guys. They do such good for the American Fire Service. Like you can get if you have an emergency and you need product, they'll have it on. They'll ship it to you overnight, literally overnight. And when they do. When they come in and help you out with their inventory management system, they come in and they inventory everything in your department, and they can predict for you when your consumables will need to be replenished, and they can track it all for you. They're amazing, and they do so much stuff that's for free for their customers, the people that work with them. It's just amazing, and it doesn't matter if you're looking for TFD or Elkhart or what you're looking for, they got it. I mean, the guy was right. If it goes on a fire truck, if it lives in a fire station or it's consumed in a fire station where EMS supplies a fire, they got it. Everything but the truck. They're pretty.
Yeah, I remember looking at their catalog in the days before computer ordering, and they did have a good catalog even then.
Yeah, now it is phenomenal. I mean, it's just phenomenal. And world-class people, too. I mean, they're old school. A handshake is a deal. Just an amazing company. Really amazing company.
That's great.
Yeah, I'm proud to be associated with them. And they believed in this product, Gary, when nobody else did. They kept this alive, and now everybody else is trying to get a piece of it, and nope, you always dance with who brung you.
Yeah, I like that line.
All right, Bobby. Well, I'm a little cansado, as they say in Spanish. So
Thank you for letting me be on. And Gary, what a pleasure to meet you. And I'll be calling you soon, send you my contact stuff, and you and I can sit down and conspire to continue to delude and confuse the American Fire Service.
I look forward to that, and it was pleasant having a discussion with you, too.
Appreciate it, buddy.
Thanks, guys. Have a good night. Stay
good night,
safe,
guys.
Everybody, and we'll see you.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Merry Christmas.
Thank
That's
you.
Right. Thank you for reminding me, Bobby. All right.
Thanks
see
for
you next
getting
time
me
on the radio.
Danny.
Safe. Gary?
Danny, thanks for getting me on.
I'll see you Thursday. I'll be
you
at
will.
The Rock Thursday.
Okay.
I'll look you up.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Good night, guys. Bye-bye. Bye.